Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. Welcome back to the second hour of the show. We were hoping to get Chris Emery on for the second hour of the show today, but unfortunately for me, but very fortunately for Chris, he's had a speaking engagement at a university, which is really testament to the incredible quality of the film that he has produced with his team there in Oklahoma. And he's actually speaking at a university, I believe, in Oklahoma City today. And we will be getting him on next week, and we'll be talking about the progress that he's made with the various screenings of the film around the country. And I really want to get into kind of discussing how important it is to really put the work and the effort into whenever you're doing research and whenever you're trying to produce something to reach out to people. Try to make it the best quality you can, and try to only lead with evidence and testimony that is really, really credible. And if you do that, you will make headway. You will start to change the world. A lot of people become very cynical about our ability to affect the world with what we do as activists, as filmmakers, as bloggers, you know, as vloggers. And they think, well, you know, we can't change it. It's just hopeless. The situation is so bad. We've got this, you know, overarching power structure that just ignores us. And that is actually subjectively the way a lot of people feel. But that is also, and I really would like to get into this when I get Chris on next. So that is actually a state of psychological conditioning that, in fact, presupposes it. It creates the conditions that it implies, because when you believe that you are in a state of helplessness, you become helpless. And this was actually all described in George Orwell's 1984. I mean, that book is like a textbook that lays down all of the techniques for creating a totalitarian society. And one of the most important techniques is to make people believe they are powerless. And, you know, they may be powerless, or they may not. They may be somewhat limited in what they can do, or they may be relatively powerful compared to what they think. But if you believe you are powerless, then you certainly are. And from many discussions I've had with people, I've realized that most people think that we are totally powerless. And because they believe we are totally powerless, they don't actually take any action at all. It actually leads them to do nothing, because they argue to themselves, why should I do anything? I'm completely powerless. Nobody cares. It won't make any difference. So there's this incredible self-justifying, self-perpetuating psychology here that seems to have been instilled in people. And I just find it incredible. It's incredibly frustrating, but it's also quite fascinating to look at once you understand the dynamic. And of course, real social change can come about from just a very, very small minority of people taking action. And there's been research into revolutions and social movements that have shown that. And it's like, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10% can actually completely change the way society works, can lead us in new directions. So that is something to think about. And I will be certainly getting Chris Emery on next week to talk about his progress with the film screenings and his lecture at the university there in OKC. Now, I'd like to move on with some Australian nanny state news. And, you know, again, let me just emphasize that everything that we do on this show and everything that I present to you is presented to you with the hope that it will inspire you to actually do something, to actually take action, to at least communicate what you've learned or any insights you've gained, but even more so to resolve to actually change the world, to make the world a better place. That is the objective here. The objective is not simply to present depressing news that makes you feel hopeless and miserable. But it is, unfortunately, our sad responsibility to bring this information to light and to concentrate on it, to kind of focus a laser point of light on the injustices that are going on in our society for the purpose of stimulating and prompting people to take action. Now, I want to read to you today from an article that was published in the Sydney Morning Herald just a few days ago. The article is titled Bitter Pills, and you can find that on smh.com.au. And the subject is about the abuse of parents and children under the Department of Community Services care programs. Department of Community Services is the government department here which is responsible for supposedly protecting children either from violence or abuse or neglect. And they are also responsible for removing children from parents and putting them into foster care. And what we see happening in Australia is mirrored in the UK and the United States. I don't know about too many other countries, but I do know the UK and the United States have a very similar pattern of a completely overblown, bloated organizations that are populated by people who are carried away with their power. They're on some kind of trip. And they believe they have godlike powers, and they believe they know everything. And in many cases, also, there have been people within the organizations that have been found to be actually abusing children, sometimes sexually abusing them, sometimes neglect, sometimes violence. And this applies to a lot of foster families as well. And it should be pointed out that foster family care is a big money spinner. The families themselves, I believe, get about $400 per week per child that they take care of. There's a lot of money changing hands. And the people that are doing it, I'm sure a lot of them are great, a lot of them are principled, but there's a lot of them who aren't as well. But the stories I'm going to bring to you today from this article are, you know, really, really very disturbing, and it's all the more poignant to see this in a major publication like the Sydney Morning Herald. And kudos to SMH for publishing this, because it is very challenging and it is very threatening to the powers that be to have this type of news go out. And in fact, in these stories, the names have been changed to protect the people concerned. So I'm going to actually read to you from the article. It's written in a kind of a narrative way with a lot of quoted statements. So it's easier if I actually just read to you the article, and then you can hopefully find it on the internet and read the rest of it. Parents have plenty of rights, but choosing their child's medical treatment does not always seem to be one of them, especially when doctors, social workers, and the courts take a different view. Mark Whittaker looks into the disturbing issue of forced medicine. The doctor examined the smattering of sores on the 14-month-old girl. "Some of these chickenpox are infected," he said. "We're going to have to give her an intravenous antibiotic." "That sounds a bit extreme," the mother, Melissa, said. The baby's father's family had a history of bad reactions to antibiotics. "Can we try something topical first?" "No, it needs to be intravenous. She's really bad." Melissa didn't think her baby looked too bad at all. They'd only come into hospital because they'd wanted to give her some Panadol to bring down her fever. But her husband's family had a history of bad reactions to the drug. So before the baby had ever had her first dose of it, they wanted to be close to help. The father, David, came in from parking the car, and together they asked for a second opinion. The second doctor agreed, word for word, with the first. "Well, you're not doing that," David said. "You don't have a choice," the first doctor said. If you don't do what we say, we'll be calling DCS, that's Queensland Department of Child Safety, and you'll have to do what we say. Melissa and David didn't quite believe what they were hearing. The doctors left them alone for a moment. David knew what he had to do. His parents had been foster carers for years, and he and Melissa had done the training to become carers themselves. They knew how the system worked. They bundled up the baby and their two other kids, walked briskly to the exit, got in the car, removed the SIM cards from their phones, and drove hard for the border. From my experience, once a DOCS, that stands for Department of Community and Family Services, has got in control of the child, you've got to work to get your child back. There was no way I was going to let that happen. Melissa and David live on the far south coast of New South Wales and had been visiting David's brother in Brisbane. After an adrenaline-fueled drive, sinking into the upholstery at the side of every police car, Melissa and David made it to New South Wales. At 3:30 a.m., 5 hours after they fled the hospital, police turned up at David's brother's house looking for them, saying that if they didn't find the baby within 24 hours, she would die of a neurological problem. Are you getting fed up with all the disinformation, deception, spin, propaganda, half-truths and downright lies in mainstream news? Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au, and may the truth set you free.
No matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you.
Welcome back, you with Truth News Radio. Unfortunately, we had a bit of a dropout there just towards the end of the last segment, and I was reading to you from the article here from the Sydney Morning Herald, and I'm not sure how much of it actually got through in the broadcast, so I'll just go back a little bit. We were reading from the story about Melissa and David, who took their child to the doctor with their little girl, their 14-month-year-old girl, with chickenpox, and really very routine, nothing special. But the doctor said some of these chickenpox are infected, and then the doctor said we're going to have to give her an intravenous antibiotic, and the parents said, well, we don't agree with that, and then the doctors and two doctors said, no, you've got to do it. And then they said, well, we don't want to do it. And they said, if you don't do it, we're going to force you to do it. And then, of course, the family made a run for it. And they were in Queensland, so they made a bolt over the border. And they did manage to get away. But the police were actually called, and police were sent to the home of the place where they'd been staying. And this gives you an indication of how incredibly overarching and incredibly sort of jackbooted the system of control is in Australia, when you simply go to the doctor in a hospital, you surrender your rights. I mean, this is the way it's actually viewed. You surrender your rights. The state takes over. And if you don't comply, then the police will be brought in to make sure you comply. So I'll just actually continue reading here from the article. Melissa and David live on the far south coast of New South Wales and had been visiting David's brother in Brisbane. After an adrenaline-fueled drive, Melissa and David made it back into New South Wales, 5 hours after they had fled the hospital. Police turned up at the house looking for them, saying that if they didn't find the baby within 24 hours, she would die of a neurological problem. That morning, Melissa and David went to a New South Wales North Coast doctor, but didn't tell him the background story. They simply said, "Do you think she needs to have an intravenous antibiotics?" And the doctor said, "That's a bit extreme. You just need some antibiotic cream and a Band-Aid." So in other words, the doctor in New South Wales that they went to, who was not part of the Uber hospital state fascist system, just an ordinary doctor, told them exactly what their common sense had told them already, is that there was no need to reach for such extreme measures. So they were vindicated. The doctor wrote a prescription and the child was better in a few days. The police and social workers eventually dropped off the case. David and Melissa were lucky. Reason had prevailed. Doctors, in combination with social workers and the courts, have a lot of power that can be used to override the rights of the parents to choose their child's medical treatment. Last year, a Queensland court forced a mother with hepatitis B to vaccinate her 40-hour-old daughter against the disease because there was a 20% chance that the child would catch it. So our parents are being forced by court orders to vaccinate their kids. Parents are being threatened with having their kids taken away from them if they do not comply with directives for medical treatments. And in many cases, the children are actually removed. And what I'm about to read to you, continuing from the same article, is exactly one such case. This is another story. Megan wishes that she had got in the car and driven away the day they first came for her kids. Ever since her two children were born in 2005 and 2007, they had had digestive problems. Jai had chronic constipation and Nina had chronic diarrhea. For years, no doctor could explain it. But a local pediatrician in southwest New South Wales sent her to one of his old university friends in Sydney who specialises in these things. And he immediately ordered tests that found Jai and Nina were genetically predisposed to a disorder that prevented them from absorbing the nutrients in food. It was a huge relief to have answers. The doctor ordered digestive enzymes and various vitamins and minerals tailored to each of their deficiencies. Immediately, their health and behaviour improved. Jai, who's also been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, a mild form of autism, became more alert and happy. All was well for about a year. Megan had made their childcare centre aware that her kids were sensitive to chemicals. She used vinegar and bicarb for cleaning at home. So when she found out that the children had been cleaning their own mattresses at childcare with disinfectant chemicals, she complained to the centre. The records show that the very next day I got reported to community services, she says. I think the childcare centre got sick of giving the tablets because it was time-consuming for them. There are about four tablets. One was a digestive enzyme before meals, and the other three were for after meals. And look, these digestive enzymes are quite common. I mean, I was prescribed some, actually, by my dentist, based on the fact that I had indications of a bit of a gastric reflux. And my dentist prescribed some digestive enzymes. This is very, very common. It's not sort of outlandish, a wacky therapy. Anyway, returning to the article. Social workers came on a Friday afternoon. They apparently always come at this time because it's harder to get legal representation. But Megan didn't yet know things like that. She didn't yet live in the world of courts and affidavits and supervised access. The mere word docs had that pejorative taint that she didn't quite want to admit feeling. Megan was a registered nurse who had volunteered for the Salvos and Lifeline. Her husband, Pete, was a public servant in a position of responsibility and was also a long-time volunteer in the local community. "We've got concerns about the medications the children are on," the social worker said. "You'd better come in," Megan replied, certain that if they just sat down and talked, they'd see their mistake, would see the children were very much loved and nurtured. The social workers produced a list of the substances of concern. "No, they're not medications," Megan said. "They're vitamins, and they're all ordered by their doctor." The doctor's name was on the bottles. She got on the phone to the Sydney GP, who told her she had nothing to worry about. No one in the room realised this family was about to become a border skirmish in a larger battle over the direction of modern medicine, and that the children would soon become prisoners of this war. The social workers had spoken to the paediatrician who had sent Megan and kids up to Sydney looking for answers. The paediatrician now said those answers, all those enzymes, probiotics and vitamins, were pseudoscience whose safety was untested. The social workers had also spoken to Jai and Nina's Sydney paediatrician and recorded it in an affidavit. He stated that he had no concerns in relation to the family. It was not unusual for a child to be taking this many vitamins. They were safe and would not hurt the children. So there was Megan sitting with the social workers when they came out with their second allegation, that the children had seen too many doctors. They said she'd taken them to 12 in 2 years. That didn't sound right. Megan could think of only four. She'd later realised they'd counted the names of all the pathologists who analysed the blood tests. The third allegation against Megan was the number of different diagnoses given to the children. For example, Nina had gastrointestinal reflux, bloating and diarrhoea, among others. Megan, of course, objected, "These are not diagnoses, these are just symptoms." And even if she had seen lots of doctors and her kids really did have lots of diagnoses, she wondered, what was wrong with that? Only later did she realise that the social workers were trying to fit her in to the largely discredited profile of Munchausen syndrome by proxy, in which sufferers are said to invent or cause problems in people under their care, often children, in order to gain attention. So this is really, really an unbelievable story, an unbelievable story of the abuse of power. I will continue it after the break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. It's great to be talking to you today. My name's Hereward Fenton. I'll be right back after the break.
She said she learned the hard way. Said she wanna spare the children. She said, don't give a say your soul away, cause all that you have is your soul. So don't be tempted by the shiny apple. Don't you eat of a bitter fruit. Hunger only for a taste of justice. Hunger only for a world of truth. Cause all that you have is your soul.
Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. It's great to be with you today. And do check out our website and do call in if you'd like. We have a couple of call-in numbers. We've actually got a call-in number for people in Australia, and that's just a local call cost. It's 1-300-153-372. And if you're calling in the United States, it's 512-646-1984. And if you'd like to leave us a message, just drop by the website at truthnews.com.au and you can leave a comment on our show. And we'd love to hear from you. It's always good to get comments and insights from people who listen to the show. And I might also add that the Logos Radio Network has a fundraising drive on at the moment. They've had a lot of difficulties and they're very, very underfunded organization, really, really running on the smell of an oily rag. And it needs your support. Logos Radio Network really needs your support. There is a chip-in option there on their website. If you just put Logos Radio Network into Google, you can find their site. And yeah, I do suggest very strongly that you pop some money into the chip-in to help them out. Now, just returning here to the subject from the previous section there, the story of the children of Megan and David. Now, these are not their real names. And this is an indication of the degree of danger that clearly the journalist believes them to be under from even telling this story. The people who run the Department of Community Services and the government departments are vindictive. And if you go against them, they will come after you. So we are dealing with a very, very severe situation. And it has to be opposed by people power. We do have to get a mass movement up and running to overturn this. And again, this goes back, I believe, to working on each of us individually needs to understand our own psychological blocks that prevents us from doing that. I mean, I firmly believe the biggest problem we've got is our psychological block that stops us from taking action. If we can resolve that, if we can fix that, if we can cure that, I think we can cure this type of situation. Now, I might just leave it there because I've got some other articles and other information to share with you today. The story continues on. It is quite horrendous. The children are eventually taken away. They're gone for a period of months, maybe longer. I have to go through the article again to get the details out of it. But it was really quite extreme. I mean, the family very nearly loses the children completely, because once children have been in foster care for a period of time, the argument is often then made by the lawyers representing the state that now that that's happened, it's better to leave them in foster care rather than destabilize the children again by moving them back to their family. This is the type of slippery slope that you're on. Once the government has taken your kids, it is very, very difficult to get them back. And in the end, Megan and David had to comply with a whole lot of extreme and ridiculous demands made by the Department of Community Services. Essentially, they lost their case. You know, they tried initially, and they hired lawyers and spent a lot of money, bankrupted themselves, trying to win their case. And then when it became apparent that they weren't going to win, they then changed tack just simply in order to get their children back and bowed down and agreed to do whatever the government told them to do. And that's very sad. The outcome of this is very sad, because the family is now pretty much under the watchful eye of the government, and they had to buy certain foods and they had to have like Kit Kat bars and, you know, junk food in the house. Literally, they had to have ridiculous things like that to please Department of Community Services. And they live in constant fear that any day there could be a knock on the door and the kids could be taken away. And it could happen simply as a result of someone saying something bad about them, some little bit of information gets out through school or whatnot, the kids are taken away again. That's the situation. It's real. It's not an exaggeration. This is a very, very mainstream, middle-of-the-road, major publication here in Australia. This is what we have reached. This is what we have sunk to in Australia. Now, the next story, is exactly on a par with the previous one and equally demands a response. Demands a response. I mean, if you're not motivated to do something by this, there is something wrong with you. And I don't wish to criticize people. It's not my, you know, it's not my job or desire to judge anyone. But the next story I'm about to bring to you must motivate you to take some action. And this is from the ongoing inquest on the death of Roberto Laudisio, who was tasered to death by police during a psychotic episode that he suffered due to ingesting some drugs. And, of course, you know, not justifying the use of drugs, not saying that he was not irresponsible. No, tick, tick, all those boxes. You know, naughty boy, shouldn't have done it. He was only about 20, 21 years old, okay? He made a mistake, okay? And he did apparently pinch a packet of biscuits from a 7-Eleven store, but in a clearly disordered, psychotic state. He never used violence. He never, from multiple witnesses have said, he never swung at the police, he never attacked police, he simply ran. And when they say violently resisted, well, you know, he ran and he didn't want to be held down, he kept trying to get up. In one case, he turned on his side when the police had their knee in his stomach. I'm just going to play to you a short clip from some of the news reports on the inquest, and I might also point out the only reason there has been an inquest into this case is because Roberto Laudisio came from a very wealthy family in Brazil. It's only money that has caused this to come out, and we've seen this in the past before. There was a case in the US, I believe in Florida, and I can't remember the exact details, but it turned out that a man was tasered to death who turned out to be the son of a former policeman. And that story eventually came out, and I believe that the policeman who delivered some of the tasers has now been put on trial. But, I mean, these are just the tip of the iceberg, these celebrated cases. There are hundreds more, maybe thousands more, that are happening every year that we do not know about simply because the people don't have money, they're not significant in any way. So let me now play to you from the ABC Australia news coverage of the taser inquest. And just getting it up for you here. Inquest hears of tasered man's final moments.
The coroner has released footage of a Brazilian student being tasered in Sydney moments before his death. An inquest is trying to establish how and why Roberto Laudisio Curti died. The police officer who fired the taser says its use was justified. And a warning, this report contains confronting images and language.
Roberto Laudisio Curti's family says although the vision is incredibly distressing, it should be seen by the public. The images are grainy, but this could be the clearest version yet of what happened.
Taser! Taser! Stop resisting! Stop or you will be tasered again!
I'll just pause it there to describe what you're actually seeing during this part of the video. You can actually see this is actually a CCTV video, and you can see Roberto Laudisio lying prone on the ground. He's not wearing a shirt. He's completely inert. He's surrounded by police, and he's not resisting in any way. He is just lying completely prone on the ground.
Police officers crowd around Mr. Curti. Capsicum is sprayed into his face and they attempt to handcuff him. Then, suddenly, Mr. Curti is tasered again. In a statement, the family said, only through honesty and transparency will we get to the truth of what happened. Senior Constable Eric Lim was the man behind the taser. He told the court he'd made two failed attempts to grab hold of Mr. Curti, who was sweating. Police were trying to arrest the Brazilian over a robbery at a convenience store. Under the influence of the drug LSD, he'd taken two packets of biscuits, and the initial reports on police radio suggested he had a weapon.
Brock's car, any car in the vicinity for an armed robbery, city convenience store.
The mistake was later corrected, but some officers still had the misunderstanding it was an armed robbery. Senior Constable Lim said he was no physical match for Mr. Curti and feared he would be injured if he tried to tackle him. He also defended using his taser twice. The inquest also heard from several eyewitnesses, including Tommy Wang, who said police went too far.
He was empty-handed and there were six police. Yeah, over one man.
From her hotel window, another witness saw an earlier attempt by police to taser their suspect.
Wendy Price told the court Mr. Curti was violently resisting arrest, but when questioned further, she also said she never saw him punching or assaulting police.
Like they want us to be afraid, man. Or maybe we just like being afraid. Maybe we just so used to it at this point that it's just a part of us, part of our culture. Security alert on orange. It's been on orange since 01, G. I mean, what's up, man? Can a brother get yellow, man? Just for like 2 months or something? Goddamn. Sick of that. Mic check. The groove is thick, so I'ma rhyme like a lunatic. I do this shit with an unassuming wit. The corporation conjured up the bass and the tempo. My name is Liv, that's the intro, now let's go. The flow of life throwing strife into the mix.
Hi, welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm just playing to you a video clip here from the ABC News coverage of the inquest into the death of Roberto Laudisio. And just before we went to break there, I was playing some clips from witness statements. Now, I'll just continue with another clip which explains how the man was in a psychotic state.
An inquest into the death of a Brazilian student tasered by police has heard he'd taken LSD and appeared to be in a psychotic state. A psychiatrist who viewed footage of Roberto Laudisio Curti on the night he died said his behaviour was abnormal but not threatening. The police officer who tasered him told the inquest that five of his colleagues were at risk of being overpowered. And a warning, some of the images in this story are confronting.
Senior Constable Eric Lim knew that repeated use of a taser was discouraged, but in the case of Roberto Laudisio Curti, he says it was necessary. The officer has stated Mr. Curti was bucking off other police when he refired, but when his taser cam vision was played again in court, he agreed the Brazilian appeared to be trying to roll onto his side. Counsel for the family drew the officer's attention to what appeared to be a knee in Mr. Curti's abdomen. That would make it tricky for someone to breathe, wouldn't it? He replied, yes. Peter Hamill SC also asked the officer, did you at any stage have concerns about Roberto's health and well-being? He answered, no. Mr. Hamill put it to Senior Constable Lim, you weren't justified in deploying the taser a second time, were you? He said, I disagree. Whilst on the ground, Mr. Curti was drive-stunned by one officer five times. This is when a taser is applied directly to someone's body. Even though it was in his statement, another officer told the court today he couldn't remember any drive-stunning. That prompted a clearly frustrated coroner to suggest some witnesses might think she's stupid.
Earlier, the inquest heard from a psychiatrist who detailed Mr. Curti's deteriorating mental state during the hours before his death.
Mr. Curti had taken LSD and Dr. Jonathan Phillips said his behaviour in the convenience store suggests he was in a psychotic state. He was paranoid, grandiose and preoccupied with his own personal world. He runs because he is increasingly scared. Dr. Phillips said there was no way police could have done a mental health assessment on their suspect. Carl Herr.
Just leave it there. Now, We have a situation here where police have... The real problem is that police have been told that it is completely legitimate to use tasers. The police have been given a green light to do this. And because they have been told that it's completely safe, then they're not concerned about the health effects. That is part of the problem. And that is a problem that has to be addressed. And it goes back to the basic, you know, regulation of the materials of the gun, of the technology, and the process by which it was put into general use. And this began in the United States, and it's happened for many years. It's the ongoing process that's been taking place over many, many years. Despite all of the evidence that's come through about tasers being very much more dangerous than initially described, we see them progressively rolled out in more and more countries and in more and more places, even within Australia, in more and more cities, tasers are being rolled out. But there's a dynamic here. You know, there's this dynamic of putting in the hands of the police this tool that they say that they're free to use. It's non-lethal, so it can be used in many, many, many situations. But then there's this kind of blurring of the guidelines as to how it should be used. Because when tasers were initially introduced, it was quite clearly stipulated that they would only be used in life-threatening situations where it was an alternative to using a gun. And, you know, I have to say, I'm not totally against that. I actually can see the value in that. Like, I mean, if someone is really murderous, coming at you with a knife, doing something, you know, very dangerous, or maybe about to hurt someone else, and you have to do something, you can't just do nothing, you know. If someone's in danger and you have to protect someone, or if you yourself are in danger, you've got to protect yourself. And the taser is a less lethal option than a gun. So intrinsically, I can't say tasers are bad. You know, it's like saying guns are bad. No, guns are not bad. Tasers are not bad. The problem here is all to do with the way it is being applied. And that is totally misunderstood and totally misrepresented in society. The fact that our police have been kind of schooled into this attitude that they are allowed to wield this total power over people. And there is something else. There's another dynamic that comes about when you give people that sort of power. I mean, this is actually the power to essentially torture people, because these weapons are essentially torture weapons, electroshock weapons. So although it may be presented as, you know, neutralizing someone who's about to do something dangerous either to themselves or someone else, that may be presented and that may be valid. The other potential use of this weapon is to actually force someone to do things that they don't otherwise want to do. This is what we call torture. You know, it's compliance by pain. And the application of the taser for the purpose of torture has never been approved, and yet it is regularly done. It's just done without even any consideration. It's done over and over again, and every now and then one case rises up to the surface and everyone seems quite horrified by it, but it has no effect on policy. Policy just continues exactly as it was. The media has a bit of a fuss about it, and everyone just forgets again until the next big event, which might be another year's time. So, what to do? Again, the only thing that we can do is that we actually have to vote with our feet. I mean, people really have to mobilize against the use of tasers. And I don't think the question is one of abolishing tasers. I don't actually think that abolishing tasers will solve the problem. I mean, it probably wouldn't be a bad idea at this point, considering that they've become they've just become so commonplace in that they're used in this terrible way that I think there is a case for saying, well, they should just be abolished. But that's not really going to solve this type of problem. We need people to demand that the government and the police observe certain guidelines in the way they deal with the general public. We have in Sydney a case where the police are continually overstepping the normal basic human rights that are expected in a modern democracy. Police are using sniffer dogs in train stations. They're using sniffer dogs in bars and pubs along main streets of Sydney. They're forcing people to strip search in public. In the case of Roberto Ledesio, you saw there a man clearly out of his mind. I mean, you can see from the videos the guy is not in his right mind. He's unarmed. He's essentially harmless, right? And there's six cops. Now, there's another point which really needs to be made here, is that one of the policemen had said that they were afraid because Roberto Ledesio was a well-built man, you know, strong. They were afraid they were going to be hurt. And so even though he didn't swing a punch at anyone, they thought, well, we'll just, neutralize his ability to do anything dangerous to us by using the taser. Again, there's a principle there that it's just being violated in terms of people's rights, in terms of normal behavior. I mean, the fact that the police were afraid they might be hurt, but they had no real grounds for that. I mean, the guy didn't have a knife, he didn't have a gun, there were six cops. So there is something wrong with the basic psychology that's driving what the police are doing. And it really, really, really needs to be addressed. I mean, we have a situation which is just getting worse and worse and worse in our society in Australia. And unless people take action, I mean, I really mean take action, we need to have protest movements. We need to have people out on the street, and it needs to build. You can't just do one protest event. You've got to be prepared to come back again and again and again. You've got to try and build. You've got to have a publicity campaign. We would need to have T-shirts, stickers, websites. And, you know, I've tried with some of the things that we've talked about here on Truth News, but to be honest with you, I've found it's very difficult to build the momentum. People seem to have this kind of, you know, they're very upset about it, they get very concerned, and then it all just gets too hard and they just sort of forget. I mean, they just sort of move on to the next story, the next issue, the concerns with their lives. And I think unless we get beyond that, unless we really become more strict with ourselves, and I certainly apply this to myself as well, unless we maintain our focus, I think it's pointless even talking about it. We might as well just let the police and the government do whatever they want. I mean, this demands sustained public action and outcry. It's the only way that we'll ever get change. So I do hope you enjoyed our coverage of today's stories. We'll be back next week with the interview with Chris Emery. And I do have a couple of other very interesting interviews coming up. I've got an interview with the Australian Sovereignty Party coming up, and an interview with an activist group in the US, StormCloudsGathering.com, who espouse ideas very similar to what I have just been describing to you about getting involved and getting people active and breaking through the psychological barriers. Truth News Radio Australia will be back next week. It's been great talking to you. I'll see you then.